Good evening, everyone. I originally had prepared to do something, a talk around the work that was going to be performed here, and I only recently found out that it wasn't going to be performed, so I'm kind of freewheeling things a little bit. The work that I was going to talk about, I think, in fact, I see Andrew Goetz is here, and I think he's actually going to be dealing with partly this work. And it's part of a large cycle that I was working on through the 80s and the 90s. Of course, it's an old work now, but it's almost 4 hours of music. It's called Nine Rivers. And the central work is La Capure, and it was a work that the cycle is nine separate works which interlock. They have tropes which bridge between the pieces. And the La Capure is the fifth of these nine works, so it's a central work, and it's the cut. And it's because the first of the four works are all acoustic, and La Capure cuts into the acoustic sound with electronics, with signal processing, but other aspects of... I'm using sensors for space, for the percussionists, for solo percussion with electronics. So originally I was going to talk about the way that I was approaching that particular work, because for me it's a strange work, because I'm also using video and spatialization in a way that was unusual for me at the time. But it had many implications afterwards about the way that I was working. Most of my work, anybody who's familiar with it will know that it falls into groups of pieces, or mostly actually organized as cycles. And the fascination of the cycle for me, one sense, it's a kind of deferment. I don't like finishing things. I don't mean that in a Boulezian sense of the word. I mean in the sense that every new work for me begins to throw up new implications, things that I didn't see originally in the work. So beyond the formalization of fabricating something, there's always that element of a kind of residual aspect to it, a residue of things that fascinate me. And so actually the cycle was one way of solving this. My original training in my late teens was at art school, and my first passion was painting, in fact, and so I was also fascinated by, or perhaps it's a carryover from that, that it's actually very common amongst painters to work in cycles. Nine Rivers was a work that... The greatest motivation for me, you know, it's an enormous piece, and it's unbroken. It's 4 hours. An audience has to see this as a large structure, not as nine separate works. It kind of grew out of the frustration with the concert format, and I think, you know, one of the problems we hear a lot about the difficulty of contemporary music for an audience today. And I came to the conclusion in the early 1980s that, in fact, an awful lot of this frustration and the kind of beyond all the reactionary propaganda around, you know, anti-modernist rhetoric, it seemed to me one of the major problems that we have in contemporary music is actually how it's performed. And the traditional concert format, which of course is a byproduct of the 19th century, became an increasing frustration for me. Very, very small things, but actually quite important things. For example, the presence of music stands on a stage, the endless noise from page turning, your normal contemporary music concert usually consisted of four pieces, all often unrelated. There was a stage changing between the pieces. in it for you know, as far as I was concerned, it was just continually, there was one, there was just an accumulation of things that were breaking the possibility of anything magical happening within the concert. And I think audiences are not stupid. You know, I think that, you know, arts management people like to treat them as if they're stupid. I think that often artistic directors treat them as if they're stupid. But in fact, you know, I think that it's actually that an audience understands when things are being broken, when they're being fractured. And so the idea of working in extended forms kind of partly, in part, grew out of this frustration with the concert format. Of course, once I made the decision to work in cycles, then I began to rethink the whole notion of structure and form in relation to material. I like works where part of the work itself is a confrontation with the material, what it actually means, where, why you choose this material as opposed to that material. Another aspect of my work, I suppose, is that actually I've always been fascinated by the idea of small deviations. It seems to me, you know, one of the primary characteristics of music. Eric, I'm leaning forward into this mic. Do I need to or not? No. I'm okay like this. Yeah, okay. One of the primary characteristics of music itself, or of sound rather, is the fact that it's very fragile. That it's something that by its nature is in the process of dying immediately. And so I've always been fascinated by the smallest nuance in music. The fact that, for example, Ivri Gitlis as opposed to Yasha Heifetz has a very different speed of vibrato. And one of the ways that we identify a particular musician is in all this, the accumulation of small details in their playing. And those small details have always fascinated me. And so engaging with music at that level, at the micro level itself, was one aspect of the thing that interested me. And the other thing that interested me was the macro aspect of it, the large scale form, how we can build a large structure from detail itself. And often the way that I'm working is I'm working on small details, and I'm oscillating between that and large architectural ideas about the piece. I'm less interested in working at this middle level of with the motif or with some kind of preformed material which I develop in some way. I'm more interested in the smallest transition, the small gestures, and how they can be chained, how one can gradually build up, how they can fill in this large scale notion of architecture in the work. The architecture itself, for me, the clues for the architecture will always grow out of the small details. So that, for example, if I use the example of the vibrato again, and one thinks about a vibrato that starts very slow and very broad and becomes narrower and faster, then it has a shape to it. And the shape itself, I begin to exploit this notion of this particular shape. It's not just as a simple small gesture, but it's something that can be, one can think about it magnified. Often the way that I'll construct a large scale shape is by interlocking a lot of small shapes, small gestural shapes. The other aspect that interests me is actually how we deal with pitch. You know, perhaps the only really interesting for me post-serial use of pitch in the last 40, 50 years is what the spectral composers were doing in France. The problem with the spectral organization of pitch is that it just seemed to me that they had a real problem with form. That form, whilst they were constructing pitch around the natural overtone series and a more complex reading of the harmonic spectrum, including non-integer multiples, for example, small things that lie between the natural harmonics of a sound. The formal problem seemed, because they were working with the nature of sound itself, it seemed like the formal ideas also were somehow trying to map this idea of natural the natural architecture of a sound. The natural architecture of a sound, of course, very, very simply, is that it has three parts to it. So if we think about the attack, we think about the steady state, and we think about the decay of a sound. Now, the actual, you know, these can vary, of course, a lot. You can get something more symmetrical like this, or you can get something more steep, and et cetera, of course, but and it depends on the nature of the sound, but the source of the sound. But it seemed like there are many exceptions to this. But if one takes the composer, the two composers that interested me most in from the spectral group around Paris in the 1970s was Gerard Griset and Horacio Radulescu. And they both shared because I think Dufour and Murailles are different cases. But the formal weaknesses in the work, I think, were wrapped around this notion of something like these kind of architectures. In other words, it was the works were often constructed around the notion of entropy and negentropy, the idea of something dying or something being regenerated in some way. And I've been much more interested in a much more complex, labyrinthine notion of form, where things have a notion of growth and decay in a more polyphonic sense, that things have many more layers, and so that actually the what's actually going on is a complex surface, a variegated surface, a surface where actually one's continuously catching glimpses of these processes of growth and decay. I think something else that, and this is, I kind of hesitate to talk about this, but it seems appropriate at the moment. Whilst I'm talking about the problem with contemporary music, shall we say, and you know, I don't want to overload a room full of composers who are still excited about the idea of writing music with too many pessimistic stories. But I think actually it's something you can't avoid not to think about today. Is actually what. How one can reconfigure the way that we organize ourselves musically, and that's everything from the economic level through to the aesthetic level. My own, as a child, my first instrument was the Scottish bagpipes, and I stopped when I was around about 13 playing. I was playing between the age of 7 and 13. But I always remember my first and only teacher, in fact, told me there were only three kinds of music. The first was music that makes you laugh. The second is the music that makes you cry. And the third is the music that says something to your spirit. And I think probably in a curious kind of way, this is... I've never been able to forget this. The music that makes you laugh would be in Scottish pipe music. It has very, very clear distinctions, the repertoire. Would be strathspeys and reels. They're basically dances. The music that makes you cry are the laments. And those are usually very sad, melancholic songs that are instrumental pieces which celebrate great warriors from the ancient history, or the death of a great piper, it might be, or a king. And then there's this very esoteric music, which very few people outside of the pipe who's interested in piping, the piping world. And the Scottish pipes are not folk instruments. They have this thing called the Kailmore. The Kailmore is Scottish Gaelic for the great music. And it's a very esoteric music. It's known as pibroch. Pibroch is a music that is said to have originated in India and came to Scotland many, many centuries ago. It has very, very close links with the raga system in German, in India. For example, the opening of a traditional raga is called the alap, which is a slow introduction of the melody or some of the rhythmic ideas. In pibroch, you have something called the urlar, and the urlar means the same as alap. It means ground. It's the introduction. And in pibroch music, there's increasingly sophisticated variations of the original themes, to the point where this music, which can these instrumental pieces can be 40, 50 minutes long. There's a kind of almost terrace stepping up through degrees of virtuosity to the point where the music at the end fuses. The themes are, you can no longer hear themes. What you hear is a kind of activity. It's a very and it's very, very similar to the end of a rag. I suppose what I'm getting at is that actually one of the things I think that composers, well, certainly that I think about. I don't want to lay my trip on everybody else, but is what relation art music has to the vernacular. Excuse me. And the first question that throws up, I suppose, is, what do we mean by the vernacular today? I'm also acutely aware, and which is one of the reasons I have a slight reservation in mentioning this, is because Vaughan Williams, a composer I'm sure you all know well, one of a number of great reactionary composers that we produced in the UK, wrote a book on national music, nationalism and music. And of course, one of his arguments was that actually composers should return to their roots, folk music, for the music to have any organic and social relevance. So I'm kind of acutely aware that what I'm evoking is something that actually has a potential to be misunderstood. Of course, some people would argue the vernacular tradition today is pop music or popular music, whatever that might be. I would argue against that. I mean, in the sense of, you know, in the Adorno sense of the, you know, of mass production and its economic status, and the fact that, you know, it's even questionable today what is popular music. I mean, I remember reading something, I think 10 years ago, where the popular music industry was bemoaning the fact that the CD sales were falling rapidly. And most of the major artists today were making their money from merchandising other things apart from selling CDs. So actually the notion of what is popular is actually a questionable notion. But for me personally, and this is a personal response to this background of playing the pipes, is that I never really wanted to lose touch with something that had some ancient roots in it beyond this notion of making art music. Art music, I think, is something different itself. I think when one thinks about Webern's idea of art music, which is basically what the order of the day is, actually how does one convey abstraction in music, I think is one that when I was a young composer seemed to have very little relevance for me. I mean, in the sense that it was something that I'd absorbed, I'd understood, but it didn't really have any contemporary meaning for me at that point. And I, I could never lose the sense of where I came from in terms of some kind of notion of identity and what that meant. And it seemed to me that art music was had this extraordinary possibilities of a rich way of looking and thinking through music, but it also has this anonymous character to it, you know, this anonymity that we associate with modernism itself. And you know, whether the, one could argue with how much that's to do with abstraction and how much that's to do with the fact that there's a general erosion in our notion of culture and the difference in cultures. You know, I don't know, the fact that a Japanese child is reading the same fairy stories as or children's books as someone in Midwest of America and someone in Chile or wherever today is. You know, part of the consequence of this is a homogenization of culture itself. And this has plus and minuses, of course. I thought, actually, what I would do is I'm going to play a fairly recent... One of the running things beyond the cycles that has ran through my work is the string quartet. In 1980, Irvin Arditi asked me if I would write a string quartet, and it never really occurred to me. And 2 years later, I wrote my first string quartet. I'm now working on number 8 at the moment, but this is I brought with me number 5 for no particular reason. But it's become a kind of journal for me of the way I'm thinking about technical problems or thinking about material and ways of expanding or contracting or distending or fracturing or whatever I want to do with material and the relationship that might have with the choice of material itself. I chose number 5, except that I think probably unconsciously I chose it, hence my... invoking this notion of the vernacular, is that actually embedded within this this work is a playful playfulness with the idea of something that actually has folk elements within it. But there are no quotations from folk music or anything like that. It's much more to do with the way that I'm organizing, creating synthetic modes. And so I'm working with these modes and the way that they overlap and the way that they interlock, so that what I'm looking for is something where it has a continuous possibility of almost topological transformation continuously. But it does divide up into sections, and these sections penetrate through each other in a way. I thought I'll start anyway. I'll play this. There are scores all there, or?
Thank you. Thank you.
So you can. I suppose in some senses what I'm doing with this kind of folksy material, shall we say, is that it's in a continuous state of flux, of modulation, of change. But this is an unusual work for me also, just by the sheer use of repetition in it. And it's something I've always shied away from, the notion of repetition and with all its symmetrical overtones. What is definitely very symmetrical in the piece is the way that I construct pitch, which is often around centers, so that, for example, one could imagine if I was to take an important pitch in this work is an E flat. If I take an E flat, for example, and I construct around it very, very simple, expanding, symmetrical. So we have something like F sharp, and then we have a C natural. So is this clear? We have an A, we have an A. And so this would be one very simple pitch structure, which obviously can take various forms in terms of transposition, etc. Another way would be synthetic construction of synthetic spectra, so that if I start again with the E flat as a high overtone, imagining it as a high overtone, and then I take an E quarter flat, and then I expand that to what would that be? What would be quarter sharp, and then sharp, and so that I can expand the intervals down to where I want to stop. To if I come down to a low E flat here, so that the intervals are getting. So it's a kind of pseudo spectrum, if you like. And I'm alternating between these two synthetic scales for the pitch. I'm just going to leap forward now to something else, which is a more recent series that I've been engaged with. I was the city of Leuven in Belgium 5 years ago were celebrating the 500 years since the birth of Roger van der Weyden, the Netherlandish painter, one of the great innovators of this of the early Renaissance. He's a painter who really explores the notion of tone and color and light. And I was commissioned to write a work that somehow had to celebrate or relate to this year-long celebration of van der Weyden's work in the city of Leuven. And I began to look at his work again. I was familiar with some of his work from the Prado Museum in Madrid, in particular a work called the Braque Triptych, which is a very famous work by van der Weyden. And I came across it again in a book of van der Weyden, and by coincidence, I had some performances in Madrid later that year, so I went back to look at it. All the time I'm thinking about how on earth can I, relate to this particular theme. Going back to the Prado, I noticed something in the painting that I'd overlooked before, I'd seen, but I'd paid little attention to it, and it was on the side panels where there was inscriptions that the painter had written. They were very esoteric. Some were unfinished symbols, and some were clearly in Latin. And I became interested in this notion of painters writing actually on the paintings. Of course, in contemporary painters like Cy Twombly are famous for writing on their canvases. A painter that's less famous for it, but actually plays around with it to some extent, is Francis Bacon. The more I looked into it, the more common I could see that it was this graphism. I began to actually see it as a kind of graffiti on the painting itself. Often, there's been much speculation about what a lot of the script meant. Some of it is obviously very occult, and some of it is really quotations from the Bible, predictably, etc. So the more I thought about what I would like to do, and it was for a particular ensemble in Belgium called Ictus, and so I already knew the limitations of the instrumentation. I began to think about this notion of graffiti and the idea of overwriting on a text, on a musical text, and what that might consist of. And I also decided that at that point that I was going to write, it was going to be a triptych, the work itself, which is actually not quite the same as a three-movement work for me, insofar as that there are cross references between the movements, between the three parts of the three panels of the triptych. So what was the graffiti going to consist of? Well, part of the instruction for the ensemble, I collated texts from that particular period around Roger van der Weyden. There was the famous treatise by Alberti on painting. It was absolutely contemporary with Roger van der Weyden. And Alberti's treatise on painting is really about the use of perspective, for example. This newly invented technique in painting. The other was the mystical Christian mystical writer Nicholas de Cusa, who wrote this book on it's called The Ignorant Doctor in English, and it's a very speculative, quasi mystical, quasi philosophical text from the period. And I took various extracts from these two texts, and I mix them up, and I give the performers a choice about how they use them. Some of the performers decided to pre-record their voice. Some wanted to actually speak it into the instruments, for example. The trombonist wanted to recite some of the texts. But the only instructions that they have in the score is actually when to start and when to stop with these texts. And it's very, very minimal. I mean, I really wanted it to have no more significance than the original scriptum on the van der Weyden paintings. this expanded out into... that particular work is called the Leuven Triptych. I had, at the time... two other commissions from two other cities, and so I decided to stay with this notion of linking the title with whichever city commissioned it. So the second one was the Oslo Triptych, and the third one's the New York Triptych, which is the one I'm going to play to you. It's here. One of the things that happened was that I became interested in one of the comment, a particular commentary. By an art historian about some of the script, the writing on the Braak triptych of van der Weyden, which were suggesting that there were hidden political commentary. And I became interested in the notion of this this idea of hidden messages within texts. And one of the other things that's fascinated me for a long time is the history of shortwave radio. Partly this was out of listening, you know, as a young composer, I was fascinated by Kurzwellen of Stockhausen's. But I began to look into the idea of shortwave radio, and it turns out that shortwave radio was actually invented by early radio people for state secret services, which fascinated me. And so one of the things that happened between the Lurven triptych and the New York triptych, with the Oslo triptych in between, is that I take contemporary, pre-existing texts and mix them with shortwave radio texts in the center of the three triptychs of the Oslo triptych. By the time I get to the New York triptych, I've filtered the whole thing down into specific shortwave radio recordings. And these are, I don't know if anyone's heard of these things. There's something called number stations. Does anyone know what number stations are? These are stations that, these are specific shortwave radio stations which are owned by or run by secret services all over the world. From it could be anywhere from South American, like Bolivia or somewhere, to to the Soviet Union or it's Russia, as it called, some things that never lose their spots, and including the Brits. I mean, we've got our own stations, and these stations are fascinating because they're based upon repetition. Usually the only messages that you can pick up are a repetition of number sequences, and the number sequences are constantly changing. And someone else is on the end of this writing this stuff down. I mean, there's so much speculation about what's going on with these stations, but they're kind of fascinating. So I kind of hone in eventually through the three sets of triptychs into these number stations. The only other graffiti, sonic graffiti that I use in this particular work, because it was a New York triptych, is a rather faded old radio recording of Marcel Duchamp talking. And of course, Marcel Duchamp is famous for his graffiti on the urinal, Armat. So there was a kind of connection with New York, etc., etc. Okay, so I'm going to play. I don't know how we are for time. Okay. So this is the New York triptych. Sorry, I should just say, the opening is based upon the high overtones of a fundamental, a low D natural. And the D natural is not there, it's been removed. So you just get the high overtones, and then it cuts into the fundamental. And that's the first time you hear very, very briefly this shortwave material.
Thank you. Thank you.
Sorry, I should have warned you it was so long. I suppose one of the things I wanted to convey to you was just the notion that somehow, how can one create a kind of organic growth where certain things come out of other things? They're embedded within structures, and the latency is somehow drawn out. And this is often the way that I'm working. You know, and of course, one of the most productive ways of doing this is through timbre itself, the mixing of colors. And a lot of my early work in the 80s was really looking at spectral information and how to absorb this without becoming a spectral composer, shall we say. Because of this problem I had with form and in spectral music. I don't know, does anyone have any questions or anything?
How long was that piece?
It's 45 minutes, I think, yeah. 45. Don't be afraid.
The shortwave radio material. Mm-hmm. Up to that point, I sort of had an idea of, well, I had an image of the music in my head, but after that, it just changed completely.
You mean in the last movement? Or?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Does that shape the nature of your piece, thinking about that radio material, or does that, it just applies to the last movement?
I'm not sure I understood the question. I think, for example, when the shortwave material comes in at the end, and it's not quite so simple because I make a mix, which I put on CD merely for practical reasons because the players are pretty busy, and they have to control the CD player as well. So I made a mix of material in the computer, so that you know I have this. So it's dominated by the shortwave stuff, but there are other material in there, like the Marcel Duchamp recording, and there's a small quotation from the first of the triptychs, Lerventreau triptych. For sure, when this material comes in, meaning changes. It doesn't mean the same thing anymore. The work, and so it's a question. I think that. You know, one of the things we deal with is actually the notion of meaning as a composer. You know, whether the meaning's embedded within the material itself or it's embedded within the idea or the concept. But I think here it shifts very radically all of a sudden, you know, because it's from this acoustic sound world, which is kind of dealing with timbre and space, the way the material's moving between the instruments. All of a sudden, it's focused into this rather obsessive loop. I don't know if that answers you.
I have two questions which kind of relate to each other, and both relate to painting, as you were talking about before. The first is that, like, Morton Feldman talks about painting a lot when he's writing, talking about how he comes up with his forms and his stuff, whatever. And I felt that was. There was a lot of similarity between this work and his work. Do you see any sort of connection there, in terms of like textual relations? No, none. Oh, that's interesting. And also, when you look at a painting and it's got writing on it, mm-hmm. that's simultaneously happening. I mean, you can't separate them in terms of time. So I wondered how you did choose where to put the text within the work.
I think, you know, in the first work, which is where the players themselves have got a lot of freedom about how they use the text, I mean, I do put in time points. But within those time points, they can either use them or not, the text. But here, I'm, you know, acutely aware, by the time I get to the third of the three triptychs, I'm acutely aware of what I'm going to do. And so that when I'm beginning to work the material itself, I'm deliberately creating textures which are actually going to fold into each other. So one's consciousness from the three triptychs changes, and obviously the fabrication changes.
So would you say it was a sonic argument or a kind of a linguistic argument?
Sonic or?
Or linguistic, kind
no,
of?
No, it's not linguistic. No, it's really is sonic. I'm just expanding my palate. It grew out of this rather bizarre commission. But I began to think about the notion of actually, like I said, a kind of sonic graffiti. This is a very partial picture you're getting, because the if you heard the first two triptychs, you would see that actually they were much more interventionist, the use of the text. Here I'm really folding it in timbrely, and this is why I decided to make this mix, this sound mix.
With the bell sounds and...
There's no bell sounds. Well, there are obviously the tubular bells alive, but actually those are not bell sounds. Those are actually the number stations. And the openings of the number stations, and it's synthesized bells. I hone in on one particular station. It's called the Swedish Rhapsody. These number stations all have names, and this is a very odd station. It has a child's voice reciting a nursery rhyme, and in the background, someone is counting numbers in German and Swedish, and it has this kind of it opens with this kind of synthesized bell sound, and it just became such a beautiful little object to me in itself, beyond the fascination of what's going on here, you know. I mean, you know, I suppose in some sense that I'm also kind of making a kind of lateral reference to, you know, what's going on with all of us at the moment. I mean, we don't know, none of us know what the hell is going on, particularly with new technology. We can see this with recent revelations.
This is not really a question, but could you say something about your use of silence as transition between your fragments?
Yeah, I see the silences, and I suppose this is where I would probably differ from the notion that there's a connection between Feldman and I see Feldman, for example, or Takemitsu or whoever, who use silence in a particular kind of way. For me, silence is kind of like a rupture. It's like I've ripped something, and so it should be there should be a degree of violence in it, even if I'm dealing with silence where, you know, pianissimo folds into pianissimo. For me, it still feels like this interruption, this rupture, and silence is something that, you know, I'm still learning how to use it. I find it easy to fill sound, you know, fill the air with sound, but silence is kind of it has to be structural in some ways, and you know, something structural could be also the kind of violence that you bring on. Onto a texture, or onto a statement, or onto a musical idea.
With regards to your use of what you call the use of bulk elements in, like, your string quartet,
mm-hmm.
What do you?
Quasi-folk.
That was because we were going to ask what do you consider like essential elements of. The folk influence or folk elements, and because they are not, they may not be considered not authentic per se. How do you perceive their use as part of this relation to the vernacular that you're talking about? And do you think that exploring the relation bears more investigation and inspiration for you?
Sorry, the last part.
So does exploring that relation to the vernacular? Do you think you'll continue with it?
Well, you know, it's much more. It's not. You know, I kind of invoked it only because it seemed to me that when one looks at the hysterical observations around contemporary music, it just seems to me that actually, I think there is something in the notion that if we lose touch with a simple, spontaneous music, then I think we lose touch with music and what we mean by music. And I don't mean just simply the manipulation of sound. You know, I'm talking about music as also as a social phenomena. That said, what are the elements in this vernacular tradition? Well, I suppose three come to mind. One is actually the use of pulse. The second would be the use of modality. But the most important would be the sound. It would be the sonic possibility. I mean, if one listens to, I mean, you used the word authentic. I was deliberately avoiding this word. If one listens to, I don't know, you know, I mean, I grew up, like I said, around Scottish folk music and also the classical pipe tradition. If you listen to, for example, Gaelic, unaccompanied Gaelic singing from the Western Highlands of Scotland, you know, it has this timbral quality that is completely, we've lost within classical music. We don't use it anymore and we don't know how to employ it. And this is partly an indictment of the conservatories and the way that singers are trained. And you know that we as composers are at the tail end of this training. I mean, we're working with musicians who've in some respects been overtrained, which seems like a tautology, but and in some respects have been trained in a very particular, highly specialized manner. This for me has always been a source of frustration because, for example, I really struggle to work with trained singers often. I just don't find their voices as interesting as voices in more vernacular traditions or more popular traditions. Having said that, I recently heard Sting singing John Dowland, and it made me want to throw up. So I don't think that works as well, you know. So that's something else. Mind you, I mean, Sting makes me want to throw up anyway, so I don't. It doesn't have to sing. It's the sound. I like a certain earthiness in the sound, shall we say, and a certain roughness. But one of the things that I suppose that I'm doing in the string quartet, and you know, I do want to reiterate that I hesitate, you know, to push this vernacular aspect of it. It's just something that actually, for me, you know, I think for someone who didn't grow up around a certain folk tradition, I think it would be synthetic. But for me, it's something that it's in my blood, if you like. And I don't particularly want to rid myself of it, but neither do I want to create fake folk music, or neither do I want to invoke some nostalgia for the past when things were innocent and people were romping in the fields. So it's a kind of complex one that I'm still explaining to myself, but the only way I can explain it to myself is in my work. And it's an attitude as much as anything, an attitude to sound, an attitude to pitch. And this rediscovered attitude to pulse in these works. I mean, pulse, again, repetition and pulse has been something that I deliberately knocked out of myself when I discovered Stimmung. And so I had to reassess what I meant by that. And I remember I went to a lecture with Stockhausen in 1971 in London, where he associated pulse with fascism and marching troops. And again, it's one of those things, some things stick with you. And it's kind of difficult to exercise them from your thinking. And it was not really until about the mid-90s that I began to play around with pulse again. But by play, I mean in the ludic sense of the word, or in the Derridean sense of the word, being, shall we say, a kind of deconstructive play.
Thank you. This question is actually a little bit informed by your answer to the previous question. But when I think of graffiti as a medium, it's not necessarily a double-blind medium, in that the graffiti is aware of the surface and the work that's graffitied upon. but the original work is not aware of the graffiti.
The original?
The original work that is graffitied upon is created without the intent of being graffitied upon, of course. And but what I found really interesting about the New York triptych is that so many of the layers and textures felt very organic and from a single place. A lot of the, I'm not sure if this was your intent or not, but a lot of sort of these very stringent, belligerent rhythmic ostinatos and polyrhythms sort of felt almost derivative of the shortwave radio recordings and rhythmic repetition of that. And I was wondering which elements are you would consider graffiti within the piece.
Question. I realized, you know, the reference to graffiti is not. I'm not wholly consistent about the way that I'm thinking about it. But you know, I think it was Marcel Duchamp who said that he spent his life training himself to be inconsistent. Like I said earlier about the relationship, by the time I get to the New York triptych, I mean, my whole thinking about this thing has changed somewhat. So it's true that I think the use of these external sonic sources within it are deliberately being manipulated in such a way that I'm really textually folding them into the whole harmonic schemata of the work itself. And I suppose really that was the transformation from the early rather interventionist use of it to something that it became. You know, it's kind of like creating a net, and so that the interconnectedness of things, even disparate elements, and definitely, I mean, you know, the craft aspect of my work is something that does fascinate me. How one can make these connections. I mean, audible connections between things. And that really does mean looking, somehow going inside the material. You know, whether it's just, you know, as Pauline Oliveira says, copyrighted deep listening, or if it's a question of some kind of manipulation at the level of craft itself. It's true that that, you know, it, I think the notion of a graffiti falls apart by the time we get to it.
It's a very cohesive piece.
Yeah, I'm aware of that, and that's what I'm trying to do, of course. Yeah. You know, but you know, sometimes, you know, it's difficult to stop the craftsman coming out.
True. Anyone else want to say?
You mentioned, the social function of music, and Stockhausen as well, the marching of jackboots, as he says. But also, I mean, Stockhausen's been, obviously he's a politicized composer, and so were his pupils. I mean, Cornelius Cardew, Stockhausen serves imperialism, and things like that. Mm-hmm. Do you consider your music to have a social function? And you mentioned that the radio stations and kind of our position within society and all of that lot. Do you think that your music has a social role, or is it simply an expression of your response to this situation? Or do you think there is a mechanism there that you are taking advantage of?
I'm sure that it has a social function, but I couldn't tell you what it is. Cardew turning on Stockhausen, and I think, you know, Cardew's rather simplistic idea of actually making his music more socially available or accessible or whatever seems to me completely the same kind of response I objected to when I talked about arts management's manipulating audiences. That just seemed to me an insult. I think one of the things that we as composers who are engaged with this thing called art music, and even I really recoil at that term itself, deal with it in our own kind of way, but I do think it's part of. It should be part of our thinking about how we place it. But you can do this in a passive or a more proactive way. And for me, the only way really that I can do it with any degree of, and I'm going to use the word I've been trying to avoid, authenticity, is in the work itself. And, you know, I can't control other forces. I can, to some extent, if I create something like Nine Rivers, this large-scale work, if someone decides to perform it, then I've already had a degree of control over how the concert, what constitutes a concert. I know that probably, and you know, I spend half of the year in the States, and so I know that this has become something that's become perhaps more pressing for me. I mean, just because of the terrible conditions that musicians have to work under in America. I mean, you have these extraordinary musicians everywhere, performers in particular. And there is no, they have to become business people to create conditions to work within, which means that, you know, they're already there, they're balancing a number of things which I think are incompatible. I'm in Minneapolis, you know, which is, you know, probably the most smug city in America. It tells everybody it's got, you know, like all the biggest number of theaters outside of New York. It's got two major orchestras. Not even Chicago's got two major orchestras. It has all these theaters and not one experimental theater, for example. There's not one contemporary music ensemble. There's something called a contemporary music ensemble called Zeitgeist, and it's a joke. And they've been going for 30 years, and they give a concert, and before a piece that's remotely difficult, and something that's remotely difficult is something like sonatas and interludes of John Cage, they apologize to the audience first, and they explain to it and say, you know, and you might occasionally hear some dissonance, and this is, you know, and so, and you know, this is the state of the Midwest in America. You know, people. You know, I go to New York. New York's this little island floating off the continent of this thing called America, but it's not America. And I love New York, but you have this thing from like Philadelphia to the Rocky Mountains, and that's America. I remember when I first went there, and I should just add, before anybody asks, they pay me a lot of money. Before I went to Minneapolis, I mean, I had an assistant who I worked with here at IRCAM, an American guy called Kyle Fire. And he rang me and he said, "Now you've been to America. Because this is America, this Midwest." And it's kind of those conditions. I have doctoral students who boast they've never heard any Browns. I mean, they're proud of it. I apologize to all the gringos, yeah? Thank you.